Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome a guest co-host today, Dr. Elizabeth Parks. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, we're going to have a really interesting show today, including a conversation we recently had with Dr. Thomas May, senior scientist at the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology, about the challenges faced by adoptees and others who don't have access to the genetic relatives' health history. Interesting topic. I'm sure you've cared for some adoptees in your training at some point in time, and this is something I think that's important to all of us.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting topic. In primary care, we talk a lot about family history and how that can affect patients' risks for certain conditions, and adoptees, unfortunately, can be lacking in that knowledge, and that can have profound impacts on how we screen them and how we plan to treat them moving forward.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, we've got some really interesting research that matters. And let's dive right into the very first research that matters. It has to do with, are young adult men less likely to get high blood pressure treated? Do you ever see young adult men in your practice?
No. This is a really common thing we talk about.
First time ever.
Yeah. Young men are typically, I think, like to stay away from primary care docs. You know, we see young women much more commonly, normally due to prenatal care or their need for contraception.
Yeah, and this was really interesting because I do see young adult men, but a lot of times I will say, you know, your blood pressure is elevated. I recommend you get it treated. And then like 2 years go by and they come back and like, well, what happened in the last 2 years? You didn't get your blood pressure treated. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not an abnormal. Well, it's abnormal, but it's not like that doesn't happen frequently. And this research was examined data from more than 41,000 people from 1999 to 2014, estimates that only half of the 6.7 million young adults with high blood pressure received treatment, and only 40% was under control. That was kind of shocking.
Yeah, that is shocking, especially when we think about kind of how prevalent hypertension and high blood pressure diagnoses are in older populations. This study also showed that, in contrast, the older populations are 83% of them will be treated for their high blood pressure.
Yeah, and this was actually in the journal Hypertension. That's the appropriate name, I think, for something about high blood pressure. And it was interesting that most of the abnormality came from young adult men rather than young adult women. The young adult women, probably for the reasons that you mentioned, Elizabeth, were more likely to get their blood pressure seen and treated. So I think the message here is if you are a young adult man or you know someone who's a young adult man who has high blood pressure or their blood pressure was elevated, encourage them, encourage yourself, encourage your spouse or your friend to get it treated.
Definitely. I think that sounds like a great plan.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about cholesterol, good and bad. Seems like this was a story that was an easy one to tell. LDL is the bad cholesterol, get it as low as you can, and HDL is the good cholesterol, get it as high as you can. Maybe that's not the whole story.
Yeah, that's what it's looking like from this new study that was published in the European Heart Journal, a study conducted out of the University of Copenhagen.
Yeah, they had 116,000 men and women, average age of 57, followed for 6 years. And looking at their death rates and the kind of things that may be related to it, including that HDL, the good cholesterol, and the LDL, the bad cholesterol. And they did find that, you know, HDL is generally protective and LDL is generally bad. But if you had too high of an HDL or too low of an LDL, your risks were actually just atypical. They were worse.
Right. And this is kind of contrary to what we've been telling patients for quite a long time, that HDL is the good cholesterol and the higher the better is often kind of the line we've given. So in this case, it looks like extreme elevations of HDL can actually increase risk of mortality.
Yeah, these were HDL levels of 97 to 115. And I got to be honest with you, I've only seen like one or two ever in my practice of 20 plus years. So I don't want people to get concerned. Certainly an HDL level in general is protective mm-hmm. there. And an LDL level under 39 wasn't so good. So we do want it lower, but I don't have too many patients who's under 39. It suggests that if you have abnormally high HDL and abnormally low LDL, talk to your doctor.
Right.
Sounds like a good idea. Talk about good ideas. If you were a religious young women, who many of our patients would fall in that category, would you be less likely to get the vaccination against HPV, human papillomavirus? What do you think?
Yeah, that's what this new data is looking like. There's a large study conducted in Utah that looked at the rates of knowledge about the HPV vaccine as well as rates of actually getting the HPV vaccine. And it seemed like those who self-identified as being religious were lower in both categories.
Yeah, they said that compared to the women who didn't practice a religion, those who did were 60% less likely to know about the human papillomavirus and about half as likely to have received one dose. So I could certainly understand that if you're religious, that you might think that, oh, I'm at less risk. I'm not going to have multiple partners. I will know the status of my partner. But we wouldn't expect them to know less about the vaccination. That's a little bit of a cause for concern.
Yeah, that does seem odd. And I think it also really brings up the idea of, you know, informed consent. If you don't know about something, you might not be making kind of the best decision for your health and your life.
Yeah, about 50% of the religious women say they'd received at least one dose of the vaccine compared to 73% of the non-religious women. And we know HPV infections cause a whole host of cancers of the cervix, of the vagina, the penis, the anus. These are things that could be prevented with this vaccination. And I don't think we make assumptions about what people would like to know and the type of behaviors they may choose. We have to give them the information.
Exactly. And I just want to use this opportunity to make one more plug kind of to increase our HPV vaccination rates. I think it's a really great option we have for preventing cancer in the future.
I believe in that. And I'm not going to say to drink to that because I don't want to have the alcohol, but I'll drink water to that. That's a good idea. Let's talk about our last research that matters. And this is about malaria and black howler monkeys. Elizabeth's laughing here because it's a black howler monkey. It's not a black laughing monkey, is it?
No, but I've actually run into black howler monkeys and they're no joke.
Where did you hear it?
In Costa Rica. One threw a coconut at me one time.
Oh, did it really? No. This one did not throw a coconut at me, but I think it was laughing at me from the trees because I'm sitting there trying to see it up in the trees. But they're really loud.
They are.
But really fascinating. And this is a question about, are they a vector? Could they transmit malaria, which we typically think of going from human to human from mosquitoes, biting one human and then biting another. But this is something different.
Exactly. This is a study out of Brazil which thought that they had eradicated malaria that showed a possibly new parasite found in monkeys that had affected a certain number of people in the Rio area. It seems like their concern is mostly that you could be transmitted from monkey to human versus by mosquito, but they're pretty convinced that you can't transmit this version of malaria human to human by mosquito.
Right. And why this was, I think, of interest is that these were in some areas that it was thought malaria had been completely eradicated. Mm-hmm. But yet there is this potential source and vector. It's kind of rare. And I think the biggest thing is if you are going up into the mountains and areas where there is any malaria possible, you would do everything you can to prevent it, including netting and clothing and DEET, putting the sprays on, common sense things that would really, I think, make your risk very low and maybe even take the antibiotics to prevent it.
Yeah, definitely. Prophylaxis is available when you're traveling, and I think that would be a good idea in this case.
Yeah, well, this was published in Lancet Global Health Journal, and this will conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll listen to a conversation that Dr. Adia Hines and I recently had with Dr. Thomas May, senior scientist of the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology, about the challenges faced by adoptees and others who don't have access to their genetic relatives' health history. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, and Dr. Elizabeth Parks will be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Adia Hines. Today on Conversations, Adia, we're talking with Dr. Thomas May, senior scientist at the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology,
about the challenges faced by adoptees and others who may not have access to their genetic relative's health history. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. May.
Thank you very much.
I think this whole topic, which we could probably spend hours, is one that I don't know why, but we don't talk so much about in medicine, but is one that really affects so many of our patients. Tell us how you got interested in understanding some of the challenges faced by adoptees.
Well, I've done some work when I was in Wisconsin with the International Adoption Clinic and also recognizing the importance of family health history for my own daughter's health. At the same time, I was working very closely with a professional clinical genomics team that existed there that's now located at Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology here in Alabama. And I was motivated to explore just how these emerging genomic technologies might be used to fill gaps in family health history among populations like adoptees who lack family health history.
Help us understand what would be if we kind of went back 20 years and were having this conversation. What sort of things would we be talking about in terms of health of adoptees, and what would be some of the limitations at that time of that conversation?
You know, a lot of times we use family health history to recognize that certain conditions might run in our family. And as medical technology and medical science improves, the role of family health history really is increasing. But it's always played a role in helping doctors, for example, look for certain symptoms, helping doctors to interpret certain symptoms, and to know when we can apply sort of population screening protocols earlier than they might otherwise be applied, right? And to utilize this information to help us understand what risks we really should be aware of and looking to address as soon as we see the first signs of those risks. For most people, this sort of information is available through simple observation. We recognize that grandma died of, you know, breast cancer, grandma's mom died of breast cancer. It runs in our family. And so we can be mindful of that and take whatever actions are available at any given time to try to address these higher risks that run in our family. But for some populations, like adoptees, there's often lack of access to this sort of family health history that we can notice things have run in our family that would help us to interpret certain symptoms or look for certain symptoms or to take preventive actions. And it's only recently that we've seen genetic technologies advance to the point that they really can come to start to help us fill some of these gaps that exist in this information and risk assessment. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, Dr. May, I was really excited to learn a little bit about, you know, your research and have you on the show today, as this is a question that often plagues me personally. Neither of my parents are, you know, from the U.S. And though I was raised by my biological parents, I know their history and maybe to a limited extent my grandparents. I don't know my more extended family. So this is something that has affected me, you know, personally in my conversations with doctors and something I think about, you know, as I've gone through my own training. So thank you so much. I know that you've had a few studies about the subject that have been published recently and would love for the public to hear a little bit more about what you found.
Sure. Well, what we found is that, first of all, unsurprisingly, adoptees are very much interested in gaining this information. What is surprising, however, is that adoptees are actually more interested in finding out about some of this health risk information and this what I call family health history information than they are even sort of ancestry information, which is what I think a lot of people assume might be at the top of the radar of adoptees. What we found is that adoptees want this information for a variety of reasons. While it may not be at the top of their priority list when they are young, when they reach adulthood, in young adulthood, sort of in the mid-20s, it goes to being one of the most important areas of information that they're seeking, is this sort of genetic health history. And that's for a number of reasons. Number one, I think that it's important in sort of central life planning, things like having children, wanting this information to be available to their children, reproductive decision making. And it's also important in terms of decisions about when and how to seek reunion with birth families for many adoptees. We had in our focus groups one adoptee who directly said, you know, I'm not really sure whether or not I want to have reunion with my birth family. And having this health information available through genetic testing would make that optional. It would allow me to choose based upon my own values whether I want to have that reunion. It wouldn't force me to seek that reunion just to get this family health history information. And I think those are the reasons that go behind many adoptees wanting this information, and also shows some of the roles that this information can play in helping improve the lives of adoptees beyond where we find some direct high risk. Even those that we don't find that high risk in can benefit by having these other aspects of their lives contributed to.
You know, we had Dr. Alondra Nelson on the show not too long ago, and actually this is in part how we got interested in really talking with you and hearing about doing genetic testing, not necessarily always about getting information about family history risk, but about a way of connecting, and that offering for many people ways of connecting to either prior generations or prior regions of the world, or making connections with people. Is that the same as it may relate with adoptees, or is it even more so something that has a benefit? Because I know you said people want to know it certainly for the genetic disease risk.
Yeah. Well, I think that what we found among adoptees is that there's even higher interest for the health information than there is ancestry information. But I think there's equally, and I mean equally here as compared to the rest of the population that aren't adoptees, some curiosity about ancestry information. I think a lot of people have that sort of curiosity that they would like to explore, and adoptees have obvious reasons for wanting to explore that in some cases. But for the adoptees that we've spoken to, it's really more of a sense of control within their own life, both about birth family reunion decisions, and also, and I think this is true of everyone, our genetic sort of health information seems more related to our identity than some other health information that we might seek. You know, our blood sugar level or our cholesterol level, we seem to think of that as separated from our identity in some sense, whereas our genetic dispositions we seem to take more as reflective of our identity. And I think that that's true in adoptees as well. So I think there's a particular interest in some of this genetic health disposition information.
You know, I know that you have also been very involved in leadership in biomedical ethics and clinical ethics and throughout your career. How do you understand this from an ethical perspective? And where does this come in terms of, is it an ethical necessity? Are there conundrums? How did you approach it from that perspective? Or can you even separate it from the perspective of genetics?
Well, one of the early issues that motivated my interest in this area was the idea that there are some segments of society, adoptees are one, but as Adia had pointed out earlier, you know, there's other segments of the society that might lack family health history as well. Persons with unknown paternity, children of gamete donors, you know, just people who are in estranged family situations, as well as many immigrants, all can have limited access to family health history information. And when we see individuals who lack this information, I think of these individuals as being at a disadvantage from those members of society who can access easily this information to assess disease risk, right? And so I think of this as, from a biomedical ethics standpoint, a health disparity that's experienced by adoptees and some other segments of our society because they lack access to this information that plays such an important role in health planning and screening protocols for most of the people in our society. So I think it's really an issue of justice, and it's an issue of filling gaps in information access that represent a health disparity for this segment of the population.
excited to continue this conversation, particularly as it relates to this as a health disparity. We do need to take a short break, however. When we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Thomas May, senior scientist at the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology, about the challenges faced by adoptees and others who don't have access to their genetic relatives' health history. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Adia Hines.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Adia Hines. We've been talking with Dr. Thomas May, senior scientist at the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology, about the challenges faced by adoptees and others who don't have access to their genetic relatives' health history. And when we left off, Dr. May, you were talking about this lack of information within the context of health disparities. And I was wondering, how do you think genetic testing in particular is going to address this particular disparity?
Well, I think that first I'll talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about exactly how we understand this as being a health disparity.
Of course.
We really did a review of the public health literature looking at how people define what a health disparity is, and we came up with sort of four criteria or four features of a differential access to some health good that represents a health disparity. And that is that you have a systematic, not a accidental, disadvantage that's experienced in an unjust manner by a population, which could be avoided in some way. So if there's something that we can't address the disadvantage or the difference between one segment of society and the other, if we simply can't address that, that wouldn't qualify as a health disparity. It has to be avoidable in some sense. And we consider adoptees as having this disadvantage or this differential access as a result of the circumstances of birth that are represented by their status as an adoptee. And since this is something that they have not chosen, I think it's obvious that it is at least a non-just differential access to this health information that's experienced by adoptees. And I think that the question then becomes whether or not this systematic unjust disadvantage that this population suffers is avoidable. And in cases in the past, when we would think about this unjust difference, there would really be no way to address this, since there's no way to gain access to this information outside of observation of one's family. However, genetic testing is now offering us an opportunity to identify at least some inherited disease risks through a means other than observation of our parents and grandparents and grandparents' parents, right? So I think that genetic testing is playing a role here in providing a potential opportunity to address this gap in access to information in ways that in the very recent past simply weren't available.
So Dr. May, let me ask you a question. Let's say I have a patient in front of me, a couple whose children are adopted, and let's say they're 8-10 years old, so they're before an age when perhaps they can make a decision. Should I encourage the parents to have their children undergo this genetic relative family health history testing, and how reliable is that testing? What sort of advice should Adia and I be giving to our patients?
That is an excellent question, and it's one of the key questions that we've been exploring as part of our research group here at Hudson Alpha. What we're trying to do is to determine exactly what the best time point is for introducing this testing to adoptees. We know that the American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics, two prominent professional associations, have both recommended against dispositional, what they call dispositional genetic testing of children. That is, genetic testing that's designed not to diagnose a problem that they're facing right now, but is trying to get at disease dispositions. And we took that as sort of a starting point from what we're looking at and asked, how many of the inherited disease associations that we're talking about are things that are childhood onset? That is, they would need to be tested for prior to reaching adulthood if it was going to do any good to test. Or how many of them are adult onset, in which case we could wait until children became of the age of majority before even offering this testing in a dispositional sense. And what we found so far is that most of the conditions for which testing would be useful and reliable under these conditions are conditions that are adult onset. So I'm right now inclined to believe, although our research is ongoing, but at the moment it looks as if we probably should wait until adoptees reach adulthood to get this dispositional testing. But again, our research is ongoing in this context. In addition, part of what we're looking into as part of our research is what array of gene disease associations are best to look at in this context, what maps on to family health history. And it happens that most of the conditions that you would notice in family health history are also the conditions we can most reliably test for. And that's not surprising, since these would be conditions that are highly penetrant and highly pathological. Those are the ones that you would notice most in your running in your family history. And those are the conditions that will be most easily identified as associated with certain genetic variants. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I noticed, just in kind of learning about you and your research, that you have an interest in health policy. And I'm kind of wondering what implications this research has to sort of inform health policy around genetic testing, particularly for this population.
Well, I think that this is maybe one of the first sort of practical uses of genetic testing as a screening tool. So far, most of the uses of genetic testing have been used for diagnostic purposes or to find features of cancer tumors, for example, that would allow us to match treatments or chemotherapies to those tumors. And what we're seeing now is that as the science of genomics expands, people are interested in the potential uses, I'll call it ostensibly healthy uses of genomic technologies to help maintain health rather than respond to health problems that people already have. And I think this use for filling gaps in family health history is one of the first uses that we can identify that could have profound effects on many people's lives in this context of no disease that has manifested yet, but is really looking at genetic testing in its use, potential use anyway, as a screening tool.
And what would you say to those patients who might be concerned about the extent to which this information is protected and can't be used sort of against them?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a concern. We have, you may be familiar, there is a law called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. Mm-hmm. Those in the genetics community know it as GINA, the acronym. It is a law that's designed to try to protect genetic information from being used against individuals, although it has limitations. It has very significant limitations. And so there's always some concerns about how genetic information might be used or misused. I think at the moment, however, we're looking primarily, at least in the context of this genomic family history project, as I call it, we're looking at conditions that the benefits of being aware of these risks far outweigh the potential downsides that might come into play. Although I think this is an individual choice that each person has to make for themselves and balance the risks of potential misuse of genetic information, for example, in employment discrimination. GINA protects against that, but only applies to employers that are have 15 or more employees. So a lot of small business jobs might not be covered by GINA. So balancing that potential risk with the benefits of having information about being at higher risk of conditions that we might be able to take steps to prevent or significantly mitigate the effects of those conditions has to be made by individuals.
Well, we want to thank, speaking of individuals, you, Dr. Thomas May, for the work that you've done over a really amazing and remarkable career spanning the clinical and the genetic and the policy and the ethical. to bring new information forward and to ask questions and help provide some answers to things that we do need to know a lot more about. So thank you so much for being our guest on Your Health Today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Thomas May, senior scientist at the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology, about the challenges faced by adoptees and others who don't have access to their genetic relatives' health history. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Ardia Hines. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Elizabeth and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Elizabeth, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I am an avid news watcher, but lately I've noticed that I'm becoming more and more affected by what I'm seeing in the news. I have two questions. First, how do you recommend patients balance keeping informed with their mental well-being? And second, how do you know if the sadness you feel about current events becomes a bigger problem?
Well, this is something that I can relate to. Every day I'm watching the news and you see and hear about things that are really difficult.
Definitely.
You know, I remember a piece of advice my father of blessed memory used to give me, though. He said, Adam, worry about things that you can do something about. Now, you might say that you could do something about everything that you see on the news, and you probably can, but there's a lot of what happens in the news that perhaps we can't do something as much about. And so sometimes worrying about things that you can't do something about, I think, is not as helpful as perhaps doing something or not worrying about those things, maybe not even being aware of them. I don't know. How do you think about this, Elizabeth?
No, I think that's a great point. To your point also, the doing, I think, can actually make us feel better. That part of the question about how do we balance and wanting to be informed with things that make us feel good. And I think taking care of ourselves, doing things that we know we enjoy, being with people who love and support us and care about things the way we do is a great way to combat this.
Yeah, you know, I think there's one thing if you hear about the floods in Houston and you donate to a charity, the American Red Cross, you volunteer, any one of the of dozens of things you could help there, versus you're hearing about the weaponization and atomic bombs testing that North Korea is doing and you're worried about safety of the planet. That's something that I think would be really natural if you see those things, but it's really hard because you don't have a whole lot in your direct control.
Yeah, that is tough when things seem like a really kind of big problem outside of our scope of contribution.
You know, I do think perhaps knowing when to tune out. I think there's a lot of people who say, you know, you should turn off your cell phones. You should turn off your connection to social media, at least for a period of time, for 24 hours, maybe for at least 8 hours. Actually physically turn the phone off when you go to sleep. Kind of a radical idea.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Good for sleep hygiene as well.
Yeah. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I take an Allegra every day, and it does help some with my allergies. But I could stand a little more relief. Can I take two different antihistamines a day? If so, which ones?
Interesting. Allergies, common problem, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see this all the time in clinic. And unfortunately, I have to recommend against taking two antihistamines a day. There are some significant side effects. Mostly, we wouldn't want you to get too sleepy.
Yeah, I think that, and it's not also for really going to be real helpful. It's not going to really do a whole lot more to take an oral antihistamine from one class and the non-sedating antihistamines. There are other types of drugs that are kind of similar. There's these mm-hmm. drugs that are for reflux that have a different pathway. So something called Zantac or ranitidine can sometimes be helpful, but more likely it's maybe, or using a antihistamine in the nose for nasal allergies, that could be helpful. But more likely, it's using a different type of drug. What comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I was going to suggest something like a nasal steroid as well, something like a Flonase. I know a lot of mm-hmm. people find that to be pretty beneficial, and it's pretty easy to do on your own at home.
There's a drug called Cromolyn, which is a nasal spray one can use that has a kind of a stabilizing effect. I don't even know a better way to describe it. It just kind of helps that nose live a better life. And then there's pills that you can take. I don't know if you ever recommend any of these pills. We use them for asthma sometimes. I think they're called leukotriene.
Montelukast.
Yes.
Right? right? Yes. Like singular. It's an easier word for it.
An easier name than the class of drugs. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those can sometimes be helpful.
Yeah. And particularly, like you mentioned, if you also have issues with asthma, which is common with people who have allergies.
And finally, I would say we forget about the common things that one can do just in one's environment. Mm-hmm. You know, I went over to my daughter's new house the other day, and I said to her and her new roommates, have you thought about checking the air filter?
Because
the air conditioning couldn't seem to get below about 80 in the room. And I pulled out the filter. OMG, that was so gross. It had probably not been changed in 3 years.
Oh, well, that sounded like good advice then.
Yeah, but it wasn't their fault because they had just moved into the place. It was the fault of obviously the other people who had been living there for years without changing it. And guess what? We changed that filter and—
allergies went away?
Well, the air got cooler. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 4-year-old has developed a new freckle or mole over the past few months that looks a little abnormal to me. Do parents need to worry about skin checks when their children are this young?
You know, what an interesting question. I wish we had a picture here. Right?
Yeah, pictures are always the best with skin conditions, I feel like.
Yeah, and though sometimes you get a picture that's sent to you and it's like blurred. It's like, oh yeah, like I'm supposed to be able to figure out what a blurred mole looks like other than a blurred mole. But having said that, anytime that there's something new that you're concerned about, whether it's for you or your loved one, well, I think that concerned enough that I'd probably want to see it.
Yeah, I think so too. And there are some certain characteristics we look for when considering whether a mole might become abnormal. Things like if it's asymmetrical in appearance, so if it's not just like a normal round mole, or if it has multiple colors in it, so it's not just a standard brown.
Yeah, if the borders are regular or irregular, how big it is. If it's bigger than a pencil head eraser,
yeah,
that would be kind of worrisome. Now, it sounds like this mole may not be that big, but it's certainly new and changing. Now, kids in general, the moles don't tend to be cancerous. But there are some conditions, some rarer conditions in kids that could be worrisome. So, you know, what harm would it do to come see the doctor?
Yeah, I think that'd be a great idea, as would be always, you know, wearing sunscreen when you're outside in the sun, especially in these hot North Carolina summers. It's the best way to protect yourself against skin cancer in the future.
And let's remember, the kids themselves are probably too young to really take that on. And don't forget that you want to cover all areas of their skin. You want to make sure that they're wearing a hat, probably with a shirt on. You want to make certain that after they get out of the water, they reapply the sunscreen and an SPF of 30, sun protection factor of 30 or greater. That'd be kind of good recommendations.
Yep, sounds great.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
Recently, I've been experiencing considerable foot pain. It's worse when I wake up in the morning or after I've been sedentary for a while. What should I do to address it?
Sounds a little bit to me like plantar fasciitis.
Uh-huh. Plantar, the bottom of the foot, fasciitis, the tissue that's on the bottom of the foot, right?
Exactly.
And itis, kind of inflammation. So inflammation of the tissue on the bottom of the foot.
People who often wake up in the morning, you take a first step and the bottom of your heel is particularly painful, or maybe when you've been sitting for quite some time and stand up again. This can happen when people have kind of either flat feet or if they do a lot of walking and activity on particularly hard surfaces.
The other things that it makes me also think of is perhaps this person could have some early arthritis.
Yeah.
You know, depending on the age, there's people who've had lots of ankle sprains, trauma, they might develop some arthritis in the foot. Though, you know, maybe not. Sometimes if the Achilles tendon doesn't get stretched out, people get some kind of chronic pain in the back there, or a heel spur, kind of a little bony spur in the heel. But I think you're right. I think that plantar fasciitis probably is the right thing. What can people do about it?
The easiest thing to do is to really work on our stretching. I know that's not a very exciting intervention, but can make a big difference. I think some people find success like rolling a ball under their foot to kind of stretch out those tissues along the sole of our feet. Also doing good calf stretching.
You certainly could do a foot massage to someone else, and that would be a nice thing to do.
Yeah, that sounds really nice.
Yeah, and they have these balls that you can roll. They have these tapes that you can do. I've seen this from like these bands that you can kind of stretch the foot. Well, that's good.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is heel inserts that you can buy over the counter can provide relief as well.
Great idea. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can share any questions or stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search R for our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our great guest interviewers, Dr. Elizabeth Parks and Dr. Adia Hines, and our guest today, Dr. Thomas May. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.